Disc 4.
They drove for 20 minutes, wipers working steadily against the rain, heater roaring. The lights of central Paris faded, and soon they were in a gloomy industrial quarter bathed in yellow sodium lamps. Debray sang along with the American music on the radio. The Englishman had a headache. He lowered his window, and the damp air soared at his cheek. He wished Debray would shut up. The Englishman knew all about Pascal Debray. He was a man who had failed to live up to his own expectations of himself. He had wanted to be an assassin, like the Englishman, but he had botched an important hit on a member of a rival criminal group. The mistake cost him 2 fingers and seriously impacted the course of his career. He was exiled to the extortion side of the business, where he was known for his crude but effective pitch. "Give us money, or we will burn down your business. If you try to get the police involved, we'll rape your daughter and then cut her into 100 pieces. They passed through a gate in a chain-link fence, then entered a soot-stained brick warehouse. The air was heavy with the stench of oil and the river. Debray led the way into a small office and switched on a light. A moment later he emerged, a large suitcase hanging from his good hand. He swung the bag onto the hood of the car and popped the latches. "It's a simple device," Debray said, using his maimed hand as a pointer. "Here's the timer. You can set it for 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 week, whatever you want. Here's the detonator. Here's the small explosive charge. These canisters contain the fuel. The bag is completely untraceable. Even if it happens to survive the fire, which is extremely unlikely, there's nothing about it that will lead the police to you or to us." Debray closed the lid. The Englishman pulled out an envelope filled with francs and dropped it on the car, next to the bag. He reached for the suitcase, but Debray put the 2-fingered hand on his arm. "I'm afraid the price has gone up, my friend."
"Why?"
"Blame it on an unforeseeable market fluctuation." Debray took out a gun and pointed it at the Englishman's chest. The driver moved into position behind him. The Englishman assumed he had drawn his weapon, too. Debray smiled. "You know how these things go, my friend."
"No, I don't, actually. Why don't you explain it to me?"
"After we spoke, I started to think."
"That must have been a new experience for you."
"Shut your fucking mouth."
"Excuse me for interrupting, Pascal. Please continue."
"I asked myself a simple question. Why does a man like my friend need a device like this? He always kills with a knife. Sometimes a pistol, but usually a knife. Then the answer came to me. He needs a device like this because his employers have requested it. If I raise my price, it will make no difference to him, because he will simply pass the cost on to his employer."
"How much do you want?"
"200.
"We had a deal at 100.
"The deal changed."
"And if I refuse?"
"You'll have to get your package somewhere else. If you do that, I might be tempted to call one of our friends on the police force, one of the ones we keep in wine and whores. I might tell this friend that you're in town working."
"Fine, I'll pay your new price. But after I use this device, I'm going to place an anonymous call to the Paris police and tell them who gave it to me. Thanks to your stupidity, I'll even be able to tell them where I got it. They'll raid the place, you'll be arrested, and your employers will take the rest of your fingers."
Debray was nervous now, eyes wide, licking his lips, the gun trembling in his left hand. He was used to people reacting with fear when he made threats. He didn't often deal with someone like the Englishman.
"All right, you win," said Debray. "We go back to the original price, 100,000 francs. Take the damned thing and get out of here."
The Englishman decided to push him some more.
"How will I get back to Paris?"
"That's your problem."
"It's a long ride. The taxi fare will be expensive."
He reached out and picked up the envelope.
"Probably about 100,000 francs.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
"I'm taking the device and my money. If you try to stop me, I'll tell the police about your warehouse, and this time your boss in Marseille certainly won't stop with your hand. Debray raised the gun. The Englishman had let the game go on long enough. Time to end things. His training took over. He grabbed Debray's arm in a lightning-fast movement that caught the Frenchman off guard. He twisted the arm violently, breaking it in several places. Debray screamed in agony, and the gun clattered to the warehouse floor. Debray's partner made his move. The Englishman calculated he wouldn't fire his weapon because of Debray's proximity, which left only one option, to try to disable the Englishman with a blow to the back of the head. The Englishman ducked, and the punch sailed over his head. Then he grabbed Debray's gun and came up firing. Two shots struck the big man in the chest. He fell to the floor, blood pumping between his fingers. The Englishman fired two more rounds into his skull. Debray was leaning against the hood of the car, clutching his arm, utterly defeated.
"Take the damned money! Take the package! Just leave here!"
"You shouldn't have tried to cross me, Pascal."
"You're right. Just take everything and leave."
"You were right about one thing," the Englishman said, as the heavy trench knife with the serrated blade slipped from his forearm sheath into his palm. A moment later, Pascal Debray was lying on the floor next to his partner, his face white as a sheet, his throat slashed nearly to the spine. The keys to Debray's car were still in the ignition. The Englishman used them to open the trunk. Inside was another suitcase. He lifted the lid. A second bomb, a duplicate of the one resting on the hood of the car. He supposed the Frenchman had scheduled another job later that night. The Englishman had probably saved someone's shop. He closed the lid of the suitcase, then softly lowered the trunk. The floor was covered in blood. The Englishman walked around the corpses and stood over the hood of the car. He opened the suitcase and set the time for 3 minutes, then closed the lid and placed the case between the bodies. He walked deliberately across the warehouse and opened the door. Then he went back to the car and climbed behind the wheel. When he turned the key, the engine coughed and died.
Dear God, no. Pascal's revenge.
He turned it a second time, and the engine roared into life. He backed out, turned around in the drive, and sped through the gate in the chain-link fence. When the bomb went off, the flash in his rearview mirror was so bright that for a moment he was blinded. He followed the river road back toward Paris, purple spots floating in his vision. 10 minutes later, he parked Debray's car in a tow zone near a metro stop and got out. He removed the suitcase from the trunk and dropped the keys into a rubbish bin. Then he walked downstairs and boarded a train. He thought about the old Signora back in his village on Corsica, her warning about the mysterious man whom he should avoid. He wondered if Pascal Debray had been that man. He got out at the Luxembourg stop and walked through the wet streets of the Fifth, back to his hotel on the Rue Saint-Jacques. Upstairs in his room, it occurred to him that he hadn't seen a single policeman during the trip home. Debray had definitely been lying about the checkpoints. Chapter 17. Paris. Gabriel decided it was time to talk to Werner Müller. The next morning, he rang the gallery.
"Müller, bonjour.
Do you speak German?"
"Ja."
Gabriel switched from French to German.
"I saw a painting in the window of your gallery over the weekend that I'm interested in."
"Which one was that?"
"The flower arrangement by Jean-Georges Herrn."
"Yes, lovely, isn't it?"
"Indeed it is. I was wondering if I might be able to see it sometime today."
"I'm afraid I'm rather busy today."
"Oh, really?"
Gabriel had been monitoring all calls to the gallery for 72 hours and was quite certain Müller could find time for an appointment.
"Just let me get my book and have a look at the schedule. Can you hold on a moment?"
"Of course."
"Yes, here it is. As it turns out, I've had an unexpected cancellation this afternoon."
"How fortunate.
How quickly could you be here?"
"Actually, I'm in the neighborhood now.
I could be there in 10 or 15 minutes.
"Splendid.
And your name?"
"Ulbricht."
"I look forward to seeing you, Herr Ulbricht."
Gabriel severed the connection.
He packed quickly, tucked the Beretta into the waistband of his trousers, then took one last look around the room to make certain he'd left no trace of himself behind. Before leaving, he walked to the window and peered down at the gallery. A man was ringing the bell, medium height, dark hair, an attaché case in his right hand. Perhaps Müller's appointment didn't cancel after all. Gabriel quickly dug out his camera and used up the roll, taking photographs of the unexpected visitor. Then he removed the film, slipped it in his pocket, and placed the camera in his bag. At the front counter, the desk manager expressed elaborate sorrow that Herr Kiewer was leaving too soon. He asked whether the work had gone well, and Gabriel said that he would know soon enough. Outside, rain fell softly on his face. The Renault was parked on the street around the corner from the hotel, two tickets pinned to the windshield by the wiper blade. Gabriel stuffed them into his pocket and tossed the bag into the trunk. He glanced at his watch. 12 minutes had passed since he and Müller had spoken on the telephone. He should be a few minutes late. The German would expect that. He walked around the block twice to see if he was being followed, then went to the gallery and rang the bell. Müller opened the door to him.
"Good morning, Herr Ulbricht. I was beginning to worry about you."
"Actually, I had a bit of trouble finding the place again."
"You don't live in Paris?"
"I'm here on holiday, actually. I live in Düsseldorf."
"I see."
Müller clapped his hands together theatrically.
"So, you'd like to have a closer look at the Hirn. I don't blame you. It's an absolutely gorgeous painting. A fine addition to any collection. Let me remove it from the window. I'll just be a moment."
While Müller busied himself with the Hirn, Gabriel quickly looked around the room. Ordinary gallery, very ordinary paintings. At the end of the room was Müller's desk, a hand-painted antique affair, and on the floor next to the desk was an attaché. Müller lifted the painting from the display stand in the window. It was a small work, about 18 inches by 12, and Müller had no trouble handling the frame. He placed it on a felt-covered pedestal in the center of the room and switched on some additional lights. As Gabriel moved into position to view the canvas, he glanced out the front window of the gallery. Something caught his eye in the café across the street, something familiar, a flash, nothing more. He turned his attention to the canvas and murmured a few kind words about the quality of the brushwork and the draftsmanship.
"You seem to know something about art, Herr Ulbricht," Müller said.
"Just enough so that I spend all my money buying paintings I really can't afford," said Gabriel, and the two men shared a good-natured laugh. Gabriel lifted his eyes from the Hirn and glanced out the window toward the café. There it was again, the sensation that he had seen something or someone before. He scanned the tables beneath the awning, and then he saw it. The man folding his newspaper, standing up, walking away quickly. A man in a hurry, a man late for an important meeting. Gabriel had seen the man before. The man who had just left the gallery. Gabriel turned and glanced at the attaché. Then he looked out the window again, but the man had rounded a corner and was gone.
"Is there something wrong, Herr Ulbricht?"
Gabriel grabbed Müller's forearm.
"You have to get out of the gallery, now!"
The art dealer twisted his arm and broke Gabriel's grasp. He was surprisingly powerful.
"Get your hand off me, you madman!"
Gabriel grabbed Müller's arm again, but once again he pulled away.
"Get out of here, or I'm going to call the police!"
Gabriel could have easily subdued Müller, but he guessed there wasn't time. He turned and walked quickly toward the door. By the time he arrived, Müller had released the security locks. Gabriel stepped into the street and started walking in the direction of the hotel. And then the bomb exploded, a deafening thunderclap that knocked Gabriel to his hands and knees. He stood and started walking again as the sound of the blast echoed along the graceful facades of the surrounding streets. Then there was something that sounded like a tropical downpour, but it was only the glass raining onto the pavement from 1,000 shattered windows. He raised his hands to shield his face, but after a few seconds, his fingers ran red with his own blood. The shower of glass ended, The echo of the explosion receded into the distance. Gabriel resisted the impulse to look over his shoulder at the devastation. He had seen the results of a street bomb before and could imagine the scene behind him. Burning cars, blackened buildings, a devastated cafe, bodies and blood, the stunned looks on the faces of the survivors. So he removed his hands from his face and hid them in the pockets of his jacket, and he kept walking, head down, ears ringing with the awful silence. Chapter 18. Paris. Paris had suffered its unfair share of terrorist bombings over the years, and the French police and security services had become quite efficient at dealing with the aftermath. Within 2 minutes of the explosion, the first units arrived. Within 5 minutes, the surrounding streets were sealed. Gabriel's car had been caught inside the cordon, so he had been forced to flee on foot. It was nearly dusk by the time he reached the sprawling rail yard on the southern edge of the city. Now, sheltering in the loading bay of an abandoned factory, he took mental inventory of the things in the trunk. A suitcase, a few items of clothing, a camera, a tape recorder, the radio he had used to communicate with the surveillance team. If the car was not collected soon, the police would impound it, break open the trunk, and examine the contents. They would play the audio tape and discover that Vernemuller's gallery and telephones had been bugged. They would develop exposed rolls of film and discover photographs of the gallery's exterior. They would calculate the angle of the photographs and surmise that they had been taken from a window of the Hotel Laurent. They would question the staff at the hotel and discover that the room in question had been occupied by a rude German writer. Gabriel's right hand began to throb. The strain was catching up with him. He'd stayed on the move after the bombing, ridden a dozen metro trains, walked countless miles along the crowded boulevards. From a public telephone near the Luxembourg Gardens, he had made contact with Uzi Navot on the emergency channel. Gabriel looked up now and saw two cars moving slowly along a narrow service road, bordered by a sagging chain-link fence. The headlights were doused. The car stopped about 50 yards away. Gabriel jumped down from the loading dock. The landing sent shockwaves of pain through his hands, and walked toward them. The rear door of the first car flew open. Navot was slumped in the back seat. "Get in," he grumbled. Clearly he had watched too many American movies about the Mafia. Navot had brought a doctor, one of Ari Shamron's Sayanim. He was sitting in the front passenger seat. He made an operating table of the center armrest, spreading a sterile cloth over it, and switching on the dome light. The doctor cut away the dressing and examined the wound. He pulled his lips into a mild frown. "Not so bad. You bring me here for this?" "Something for the pain?" he asked, but Gabriel shook his head. Another frown, another tip of the head. "As you wish." The doctor flushed the wound with an antiseptic solution and went to work. Gabriel, the restorer, watched him intently. Insert, pull, tug, snip. Navot lit a cigarette and pretended to look out the window. When the doctor had finished the suturing, he dressed the wound carefully and nodded that he was done. Gabriel laid his right hand upon the sterile towel. As the doctor cut away the dirty dressing, he emitted a very French sigh of disapproval, as if Gabriel had ordered the wrong wine for fish with saffron butter sauce. "This one will take a few minutes, yes?" Navot waved his hand impatiently. The doctor didn't care for Navot's attitude, and he took his time about it. This time he didn't bother to ask Gabriel whether he wanted anything for the pain. He simply prepared a syringe and injected an anesthetic into Gabriel's hand. He worked slowly and steadily for almost a half hour. Then he looked up. "I did the best I could, under the circumstances." A hostile glance toward Navot. "I do this for free, boy. Shamron is going to hear about this." "You need proper surgery on that wound. The muscles, the tendons." A pause, a shake of the head. "Not good. You're likely to experience some stiffness, and your range of motion will never be quite the same." "Leave us," Navot said. "Go to the other car and wait there. Nevot dismissed the driver, too. When they were alone, he looked at Gabriel. What the hell happened? How many dead? Gabriel asked, ignoring Nevot's question. 3 so far. 4 more in bad shape. Have you heard from the rest of the team? They've left Paris. Shamron is bringing everyone home. This could get ugly. The car? We've got a man watching it. So far the police haven't made a move on it. Eventually they will. What are they going to find when they do? Gabriel told him. Nevot closed his eyes and swayed a bit, as though he had just been told of a death. What about Muller's apartment? There's a glass on his telephone. Shit! Any chance of getting inside and cleaning things up? Nevot shook his head. The police are already there. If they find your car and establish that Muller was under surveillance of some sort, they'll tear apart his flat. It won't take them long to find the bug. Any friends on the force that might be able to help us? Not for something like this. That bug is like a calling card. I know, Gabriel, but I wasn't the one who put it there. Gabriel fished the roll of film from his pocket and handed it to Nevot. I got a picture of the man who left the bomb at the gallery. Get it to King Saul Boulevard tonight. Tell the troglodytes in research to run it through the database. Maybe they can put a name to his face. The film disappeared into Nevot's big paw. Contact Shamron and tell him to get a security detail up to Anna Rolf's villa, right away. Gabriel opened the car door and put his foot on the ground. Which car is mine? Shamron wants you to come home. I can't find the man who planted that bomb if I'm sitting in Tel Aviv. You won't be able to find him if you're sitting in a French jail cell, either. Which car is mine, Uzi? All right, take this one, but you're on your own. Someday, I'll try to repay the favor. Have a good time, Gabriel. I'll stay here and clean up your fucking mess. Just get the film to Tel Aviv. Good dog. On the Costa de Prata, Anna Rolf lowered her violin and switched off the metronome. Her practice room was in shadow, the breeze from the open window cool and moist with the Atlantic. A professional-quality microphone hung over her stool from a chrome-colored stand. It was connected to a German-made tape deck. Today she had recorded much of her practice session. She played back the tape while she packed the Guarneri into its case and straightened her sheet music. As always, she found it uncomfortable to listen to herself play. But she did it now for a very specific reason. She wanted to know exactly how she sounded, which passages of the piece were acceptable and which needed additional attention. She liked much of what she heard, but picked out 3 or 4 sections in the second and third movements where the effects of her long layoff were apparent to her highly critical ear. Tonight, in her second practice session, she would focus exclusively on those passages. For now she needed to clear her mind. She went to her bedroom, removed a pale yellow sweater from her dresser drawer, and wrapped it around her shoulders. Then she went downstairs. A moment later, she slipped through the gate of her villa and set out along the winding track, down toward the village. At the halfway point, she spotted a tiny Fiat station wagon coming up the track through the trees. Inside were 4 men. They were not Portuguese. Anna stepped to the side to allow the car to pass, but it stopped instead, and the man seated in the front passenger seat got out. Miss Rolf?
Who wants to know?
You are Miss Anna Rolf, aren't you? She nodded. We are friends of Gabriel's. In Marseille, the Englishman left his car near the Abbey Saint-Victor and walked through the darkened streets to the ferry terminal. As the vessel slipped over the calm waters of the harbour, he went downstairs to his private cabin. He lay on the narrow bed, listening to the news on Marseille radio. The bombing of the Muller Gallery in Paris was the lead item. Pascal Debray's bomb had caused innocent casualties, a fact which made him feel a good deal more like a terrorist than a professional. Tomorrow he would go see the old Signora
and she would chase away the Ok-Ju with her rituals and prayers, and absolve him of his sins the way she always did. He switched off the radio. In spite of his fatigue, he wanted a woman. It was always that way, after the completion of an assignment. He closed his eyes, and Elizabeth appeared in his thoughts. Elizabeth Conlon, the pretty Catholic girl from the Ballymurphy housing estates, West Belfast, Northern Ireland. She'd had the instincts of a good professional. When it was safe for them to meet, she would hang a violet scarf in her bedroom window, and the Englishman would crawl through the window and into her bed. They would make love with excruciating slowness, so as not to wake the other members of her family. The Englishman would cover her mouth with the palm of his hand to smother her cries. Once she bit down on the flesh of his thumb and drew blood. It stained the sheets of her bed. Afterward, he would lie next to her in the dark, and let her tell him again how she wanted to get away from Belfast. Away from the bombs and the British soldiers, the IRA gunmen and the Protestant paramilitaries. And when she thought he was sleeping, she would whisper a rosary, her penance for succumbing to the temptations of the Englishman's body. The Englishman never allowed himself to fall asleep in Elizabeth Conlon's bed. One night when he crawled through her window, Elizabeth Conlon had been replaced by her father and two IRA enforcers. Somehow they knew the truth about the Englishman. He was driven to a remote farmhouse for what promised to be a lengthy and painful interrogation, followed by his own execution. Unlike most who had found themselves in a similar situation, the Englishman managed to leave the farmhouse alive. Four IRA men did not. Within hours, the Englishman was safely out of the province. Elizabeth Conlon did not fare so well. Her body was found the following morning in the Belfast city cemetery, her head shaved, her throat slashed, the punishment for sleeping with a British agent. The Englishman had never been able to trust a woman since. Anton Orsatti understood this. Once a week he brought a girl up to the Englishman's villa. Not a Corsican girl, only French girls, specially flown in for the task of servicing the Englishman's particular needs. And he would wait with the old paisano down the valley road until the Englishman had finished. The Englishman found the act of making love to Orsatti's girls as cold and clinical as an assassination, but he endured it because he could not trust himself to choose a lover, and was not yet prepared to live like a monastic hermit. The assignment in Paris intruded on his thoughts. There was something that had been bothering him. The man who entered the gallery just before the bomb had exploded. The Englishman was the product of an elite unit and capable of spotting the influence in others. The light-footed gait, the subtle combination of absolute confidence and eternal vigilance. The man had been a soldier once, or perhaps something more complicated. But there was something else. The Englishman had the nagging sensation he had seen the man somewhere before. And so he lay there for the next several hours, sorting through the countless faces stored in his memory, looking for him. Chapter 19. London. The bombing of the Müller Gallery had done more than create a security problem for Gabriel in Paris. It had eliminated his only obvious lead in the case. Now he had to start over from the beginning, which is why, late the following morning, he was drifting across Mason's Yard toward Julian Isherwood's gallery through a gentle rain. On the brick wall, next to the door, was a panel, and on the panel were two buttons and two corresponding names, Locus Travel and Isha U Fine Arts. Gabriel pressed the second and waited. When the buzzer sounded, he pushed open the door and mounted the stairs. Same threadbare brown carpet, same Rorschach-esque stain on the third step, where a hungover Isherwood had spilled coffee the morning after Oliver Dimbleby's drunken birthday bash at the Mirabelle. At the top landing were two doors, one leading to the gallery, the other to a small travel agency, where a plain woman sat behind a headmasterly desk, surrounded by posters promising boundless excitement in exotic locales. She glanced up at Gabriel, smiled sadly, and returned to her needlepoint. Though Julian Isherwood clung unwisely to the paintings in his inventory,
He did not do the same with the girls who answered his telephones and kept his appalling files. He hired and drove them away with seasonal regularity. So Gabriel was surprised to see Irina, a black-haired leopard of a girl, whom Isherwood had taken on 6 months ago, still at her post behind the desk in the anteroom. The door separating the anteroom and Isherwood's office stood slightly ajar. Isherwood was with a client. Gabriel could see a painting propped on the black felt-covered viewing pedestal. Italian old master by the look of it. No one Gabriel recognized. Isherwood paced the carpet slowly behind it, hand on his chin, eyes on the floor, like a barrister awaiting an answer from a hostile witness.
"He'd like you to wait upstairs in the exhibition room," the girl purred. "I assume you know the way."
Gabriel entered the tiny lift and rode it upward. The exposition room was a place of shadows, quiet except for the rain pattering on the skylight. Large old master canvases hung on each of the walls. A Venus by Luini, a Nativity by Del Vaga, a Baptism of Christ by Bordone, a luminous landscape by Claude. Gabriel left the lights off and sank heavily onto the velvet-covered divan. He loved this room. It had always been a sanctuary, an island of peace. He had once made love to his wife in this room. Years later he had plotted the death of the man who had taken her away from him. The door of the lift opened, and Isherwood entered.
"My God, Gabriel, but you look like complete hell."
"Is that supposed to be a compliment?"
"What the hell's going on? Why aren't you in Zurich?"
"The owner of the painting you sent me to clean was a man named Augustus Rolf. Ever heard of him?"
"Oh, good Lord! The one who was murdered last week."
Gabriel closed his eyes and nodded. "I found his body."
Isherwood noticed the bandages.
"What happened to your hands?"
"You heard about the explosion at the gallery in Paris yesterday?"
"Of course, this place is buzzing about it. Surely you weren't involved in that."
"No, I just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'll tell you everything, Julian, but first I need your help."
"What sort of help?"
Isherwood asked cautiously.
"Nothing like the old days. I just need you to explain why an aging Swiss banker might have kept a very impressive collection of French Impressionist and modern paintings hidden from the world in an underground vault."
Isherwood pressed the button on the intercom.
"Irina, would you be a love and bring a pot of coffee up to the exposition room, and some of those biscuits, too, the ones with the nuts, and hold all my calls, please? There's a good girl."
Gabriel knew the basics about the Nazi rape of Europe's art treasures during the Second World War. Adolf Hitler had dreamed of building a massive Führer museum in his hometown of Linz, and filling it with the world's finest collection of Old Master and Northern European art. In 1938, he initiated a secret operation codenamed Sonderauftrag Linz, Special Operation Linz, to acquire art for the Führer Museum by any means necessary. During the last months of peace, his agents secretly toured the museum's galleries and private collections of Europe, selecting works for the future museum. When war broke out, Hitler's art thieves followed hard on the heels of the Wehrmacht. Hundreds of thousands of paintings, sculptures, and objets d'art quickly vanished, many of them Jewish-owned. Thousands of works, valued at roughly $30 billion, were still missing. Gabriel knew that Julian Isherwood could fill in the rest of the details for him. Isherwood was an above-average art dealer who'd had his fair share of triumphs, but when it came to the Nazi plunder of Europe, he was something of an expert. He had written dozens of articles for newspapers and trade publications, and 5 years earlier had co-authored a well-received book on the subject. Despite the pleas of his publisher, he had steadfastly refused to reveal his personal motivation for pursuing the topic. Gabriel was among the handful of people who knew why. Julian Isherwood had lived through it. In 1940, London and New York didn't matter, Isherwood began. Paris was the center of the art world,
and the center of the Paris art scene was the Rue de la Boétie in the 8th arrondissement. The famous Paul Rosenberg had his gallery at number 21. Picasso lived across a courtyard at number 23 with his wife, the Russian dancer Olga Koklova. Across the street stood the gallery of Etienne Bignou. Georges Wildenstein had his gallery at number 57. Paul Guillaume and Jos Hessel were also there. And your father? Isakovitz Fine Arts was next to Paul Rosenberg's. We lived in a flat above the main exposition rooms. Picasso was Uncle Pablo to me. I spent hours at his flat. Sometimes he'd let me watch him paint. Olga used to give me chocolate and cake until I was sick. It was an enchanted existence. And when the Germans came? Well, it all came crashing down, didn't it? The invasion of the Low Countries started on May 10th. By June 14th, the Germans had entered Paris. Swastikas hung from the Eiffel Tower, and the German general staff had set up shop at the Hotel Crillon. When did the looting start? 2 days after Hitler's victory tour of Paris, he ordered all works of art owned by Jews to be transferred to German hands for so-called safekeeping. In reality, the plunder of France was on. If I remember correctly, Hitler set up an organization to oversee the looting of France. There were several, but the most important was a unit called the ERR, the Einsatzstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg. It was a formidable enterprise. It had its own intelligence service for hunting down works of art, a strike force for raids and seizures, and a staff of art historians and appraisers. My God, it even had its own carpenters for crating looted works for shipment to Germany. The Rue de la Boétie must have been their first stop. The ERR went after the dealers and the collectors. The Rothschild collections were seized along with their residences. So were the collections of the Jewish banking magnate David Weil and Jacques Stern. All the Jewish-owned galleries on the Rue de la Boétie were raided and their collections seized, including the inventory of Isakovitz Fine Arts. Did your father manage to protect any of his works? Most dealers, my father included, tried to protect their most important pieces. They hid them in remote chateaux or bank vaults or shipped them out of the country. But the unprotected works were quickly snatched up by the Germans. Before the invasion, during the Drôle de Guerre, my father rented a villa in Bordeaux and moved his most important pieces there. We fled there as the Germans closed in on Paris. When France was divided into the occupied zone and the unoccupied zone, we ended up on the Vichy side of the line. But in the autumn of 1940, an ERR strike force with a French police escort broke down the door of the villa and seized my father's paintings. How did the Germans find his collection? He made the mistake of telling a French dealer what he planned to do with his paintings. The Frenchman turned over the information to the ERR in exchange for a payoff of 5% of the value of my father's collection. C'est la vie. Gabriel knew what had happened next, and he had no intention of allowing Isherwood to tell it again. Shortly after the Germans moved into the unoccupied zone late in 1942, the SS and their allies in the Vichy government began rounding up Jews for internment and deportation to the death camps. Isherwood's father hired a pair of Basque smugglers to take young Julian over the Pyrenees into the sanctuary of Spain. His mother and father stayed behind in France. In 1943 they were arrested and sent to Sobibor, where they were immediately murdered. Isherwood shivered once, violently. "I'm afraid I feel a drink coming on. On your feet, Gabriel, some fresh air will do us both some good." They walked around the corner to a wine bar in German Street and settled next to a hissing gas fire. Isherwood ordered a glass of Medoc. His eyes were on the flames, but his mind was still in wartime France. Like a child creeping into his parents' room, Gabriel gently intruded on his memories. What happened to the paintings once they were seized? The ERR commandeered the Musée Jeux de Paume
and used it as a storage facility and sorting house. A large staff worked night and day to catalogue and appraise the massive amount of art that was falling into German hands. Those works deemed suitable for the Führer's private collection, for the Linz Project or other German museums, mainly old masters and northern European works, were crated and shipped off to the fatherland. And the rest of it, the Impressionists and the modern works? The Nazis considered them degenerate, but they weren't about to let them get away without first extracting something in return. Most of the 19th and 20th century works were sold off to raise cash, or set aside to be used in exchanges. What sort of exchanges? Take Hermann Göring, for example. He owned a large hunting lodge south of Berlin called Karin Hall, in honor of his dead wife, a Swedish aristocrat named Karin von Fuch. It contained one of the largest private collections in Europe, and Göring used his extraordinary power to enlarge it substantially during the war. He treated the storerooms of Jeu de Paume as though they were his private playground. Isherwood drained his glass and ordered another. Göring was a greedy bastard. He grabbed more than 600 paintings from the Jeu de Paume alone, but he went to great lengths to make it appear as though his acquisitions were, on paper at least, legal purchases rather than outright thefts. If Göring wanted a work, he had it specially appraised at a ludicrously low level by a hand-picked fonctionnaire. Then he would immediately take possession and promise to send the money in to a special ERR account. In reality, he paid nothing for the paintings he took from Paris. Did they end up in Karin Hall? Some, but not all. Göring shared Hitler's disdain for modern and impressionist paintings, but he knew they could be sold off or traded for pieces more to his taste. One deal was carried out by Göring's agents in Italy. In exchange for 7 Italian old masterworks and several other objets d'art, Göring handed over 9 paintings seized from the Jeu de Paume. Van Gogh, Degas, Cézanne, Renoir, and Monet, just to name a few, all stolen from Jewish collections and galleries. Göring carried out several other similar exchanges involving dealers in Switzerland. Tell me about the Swiss connection. Neutrality left the dealers and collectors of Switzerland in a unique position to capitalize on the rape of Paris. The Swiss were permitted to travel throughout much of Europe, and the Swiss franc was the world's only universally accepted currency. And don't forget that places like Zurich were awash in the profits of collaborating with Hitler. Paris was the place to buy looted art, but Zurich, Lucerne, and Geneva were the places to unload it. Or stash it. But of course, the banking secrecy laws made Switzerland a natural dumping ground for looted art. So did the laws covering the receipt of stolen property. Explain the laws to me. They were brilliant and thoroughly Swiss in subtlety. For example, if a person takes possession of an object in good faith, and that object happens to be stolen, it's rightfully his after 5 years. How convenient. Wait, there's more. If an art dealer finds himself in possession of a stolen work, it's the responsibility of the true owner to reimburse the dealer in order to reclaim his painting. So Swiss dealers and collectors could receive stolen works without any fear of the law or of losing money? Exactly. What happened after the war? The Allies dispatched an art expert named Douglas Cooper to Switzerland to try to find the truth. Cooper determined that hundreds, if not thousands, of stolen works had entered Switzerland during the war. He was convinced that many of them were hidden in bank vaults and bonded warehouses. Paul Rosenberg went to Switzerland to have a look around for himself. In a gallery in Zurich, he was offered a Matisse that had been looted from his very own collection. Remarkable, Gabriel said. What did the Swiss government do with this information? It promised the Allies that it would cooperate in a thorough inquiry. It promised to freeze all German assets that had entered the country during the war and to conduct a nationwide census of all such assets. It implemented neither measure.
Douglas Cooper suggested suspending the licenses of any dealer who traded in looted art. The Swiss government refused. Then the Swiss Federation of Art Dealers told its members not to cooperate. In short, the Swiss government did what it always does. It shielded its business and its citizens from the eyes of foreigners.
Did dealers like Paul Rosenberg try to reclaim their paintings in court?
A few tried, but the deck was stacked against them. The Swiss made it time-consuming and very expensive for a foreigner to try to reclaim property from a Swiss citizen. The Swiss usually took shelter behind a claim of good faith. And remember, most of the art in question was stolen by the Nazis in 1940. By 1945, under the 5-year rule of Swiss law, the rightful owners no longer had a valid legal claim. Needless to say, most plaintiffs walked away empty-handed.
Do you think any of it's still there?
In my opinion, Gabriel, most of it's still there. From the little bit you've told me, it sounds as though some of those paintings may have been in the hands of Augustus Rolf.
Not anymore.
Isherwood finished the last of his wine, and his gaze drifted back to the fire.
I think it's your turn to do the talking, Gabriel. Tell me everything, and no lies this time. I'm too old to be lied to any more.
Outside, it was raining again. On the way back to the gallery, they sheltered together beneath Isherwood's umbrella, like mourners in a cortege. Gabriel had told Isherwood everything, beginning with the discovery of Rolf's body and ending with the explosion at Werner Müller's gallery in Paris. Isherwood had drunk 2 more glasses of Médoc, and his haphazard gait showed the effects.
"Shamron," Isherwood said sotto voce, his voice dripping with scorn. "I should have known that bastard had something to do with this. I thought they'd finally put him out to pasture for good this time. They always find a reason to bring him back. They say she's quite the diva, Anna Rolf.
She has her moments.
If I can give you one piece of advice, my dear boy, assume at all times that she knows more about her father and his collection than she's telling you. Daughters tend to be very protective of their fathers, even when they think their fathers are complete bastards. I'll try to keep that in mind. It may just be an ordinary art theft. They left a Raphael hanging on the wall of the parlor and blew up the art gallery belonging to the man who oversaw the collection. I don't think there's anything ordinary about what happened.
Point taken, Isherwood said. In fact, it sounds to me as if the only things you can trust in this whole wretched affair are the paintings themselves.
I hate to be the one to break this to you, Julian, but paintings can't really talk. Besides, the collection is gone.
The paintings can't talk, but their provenance can. Clearly, Augustus Rolf took his collecting very seriously, even if he acquired the paintings under less than perfect circumstances. He would have insisted on a provenance for each one of them. Provenance, after all, is everything.
And if I can get the provenance, then I'll be able to tell you whether he was a legitimate collector or whether the old bastard was sitting atop a vault filled with looted art.
Gabriel had planned to leave him in Duke Street, but Isherwood took him by the elbow and pulled him through the passageway into Mason's yard.
Come with me. There's one more thing I need to show you.
As they entered the gallery, Irina recognized the telltale signs of a bottled lunch. She gave Isherwood a stack of telephone messages and went to work on a pot of coffee. Back in his office, Isherwood opened his private safe and withdrew 2 items, a sketch of a young boy and a photocopy of an old document, several pages in length. He held up the sketch for Gabriel to see.
Look familiar?
I can't say it does.
The subject is me. The artist is Pablo Picasso. I carried it out of France with me.
And the document?
I carried that as well. My father gave it to me right before I set out with the Basques. It's a detailed list of every painting in his private collection and professional inventory, written in his own hand.
This is a copy, of course. The original's in terrible shape now. He handed the list to Gabriel. I don't know how far you plan to take this thing, but if you happen to come across any of these, you'll let me know, won't you, Petal? Gabriel slipped the list into the breast pocket of his jacket. Where are you off to now? Isherwood asked. I'm not sure. There's a man you should talk to in Lyon. He helped me with a few things when I was researching the book. If Augustus Rolfe has any dirt under his fingernails, this man will know about it. Isherwood flipped through the Rolodex and gave Gabriel the telephone numbers. Chapter 20. London. Around the corner from Isherwood Fine Arts in Jermyn Street, a fair-haired man sat behind the wheel of a Rover sedan listening to the radio. For 5 days he had been watching the art dealer. He had followed him to his drunken lunches, followed him home at night to his house in South Kensington. He'd even posed as a potential buyer in order to conceal a pair of tiny transmitters in the dealer's office. The transmitter broadcast a weak, analog signal over an ordinary FM wavelength. The man was using the radio in the Rover to monitor the output. 10 minutes later, when the conversation inside ended, he picked up his cellular phone and dialed the number in Zurich. Our friend is on his way to Lyon to see the professor. Chapter 21. Lyon. Professor Émile Jacobi was the self-appointed guilty conscience of Switzerland. He believed that in order to save his country, he first had to tear it down, and he had devoted his life to unearthing and exposing the unsavory elements of Swiss history. His explosive book, The Myth, had ignited a firestorm by detailing the extensive economic and trade links between Nazi Germany and Switzerland throughout the Second World War. Jacobi outlined the process by which Swiss banks accepted looted gold, and gold ripped from the teeth of Jews on the way to the gas chambers, and converted it into the hard currency Hitler used to buy the raw materials needed to keep his war machine running. Professor Jacobi's conclusion shocked the country and made him a national pariah. Switzerland and Nazi Germany were allies in everything but name, he wrote. Hitler could not have waged war without the help of Swiss bankers and arms makers. If not for Switzerland, the Wehrmacht would have ground to a halt in the autumn of 1944. Millions of lives would have been spared but for the greed of Swiss bankers. Soon after publication of The Myth, life for Professor Jacobi in Switzerland became increasingly uncomfortable. He received death threats, his telephones were tapped, and officers of the Swiss Security Service monitored his movements. Fearing for his safety, he resigned his professorship in Lausanne and accepted a position in the history department of the University of Lyon. It took Gabriel the better part of the next day to track him down. He left 2 messages on Jacobi's answering machine at home, and 2 more with his thoroughly unhelpful secretary at the university. At 1:30 in the afternoon, Jacobi called Gabriel on his cellular phone and agreed to a meeting. Come by my flat at 6 this evening. We'll talk then. Then he rattled off the address and abruptly rang off. That left Gabriel several hours to kill. In a bookstore near the university, he found a French language copy of The Myth and spent the rest of the afternoon reading among the students in a café off the Place des Terreaux. At 6 o'clock, the professor was waiting in the foyer of his apartment building on the Rue Lanterne. He wore a frayed tweed jacket and his rimless spectacles were pushed up into a bird's nest of unruly grey hair. There were clips on the legs of his trousers to keep the cuffs from becoming entangled in the chain of his bicycle. Welcome to exile, he said, leading Gabriel wearily up the staircase to his flat on the 4th floor. We Swiss revere the right to free speech, but only if that speech refrains from criticism of Switzerland. I committed the mortal sin of a good Swiss, and so I find myself here in the gilded cage of Lyon. On the landing outside his door, the professor spent a long moment digging in his saddlebag through loose papers and battered notebooks, searching for the keys to his flat. When finally he found them, they were admitted into a small, sparsely furnished apartment. Every flat surface was piled with books, documents, and newspapers. Gabriel smiled. He had come to the right place. Jacobi closed the door and hung his saddlebag over the latch.
So, you wish to discuss the murder of Augustus Wolff? As it turns out, I've been following that case quite carefully.
I thought you might. I was wondering if we could compare notes.
Are you a historian as well, Mr. Allon?
Actually, I'm an art restorer, but in this matter I'm working for the government of Israel.
Well, this promises to be an interesting evening. Clear the things off that chair and sit down. I'll see to the coffee.
Professor Jacobi spent several minutes digging through his towering stacks of paper for the file on Augustus Rolf. It was very slender.
Herr Rolf was a private banker in the truest sense of the word, Mr. Allon. I'm afraid much of what I'm going to tell you is based on conjecture and rumor.
I've often found that one can learn a great deal about a man by the rumors that swirl around him.
When one is dealing with a Swiss banker, especially a private banker like Augustus Rolf, rumor is sometimes the best one can hope for.
The professor slipped on his glasses and opened the file.
There are very small private banks in Zurich, and there are extremely large ones. The giants, like Union Bank of Switzerland and Credit Suisse, both have private banking divisions, though they handle only very wealthy customers.
How large?
Usually a minimum deposit of approximately $5 million. It's been reported that the intelligence agencies of your country utilized the private banking services of Credit Suisse.
The professor glanced at Gabriel over the open file.
But then, I'm sure you know nothing of that.
Gabriel let the question sail by. From what I know of Augustus Wolff, he fell into the first category.
That's right. The Rolf Bank was a small enterprise. Rolf and a half dozen employees, if that. If you wanted someone to hide your money or your belongings in Switzerland, Augustus Rolf was your best friend. He was one of the most discreet and most influential bankers in Zurich. He had very powerful friends. That's what makes his murder so baffling to me.
What else do you know about him?
He took over control of the family business from his father in the early 30s. Not a good time for the banks of Switzerland. There was the worldwide depression, the German panic, a currency crisis in Austria that was sending shockwaves through Zurich. Swiss banks were falling, like dominoes. Many private banks were forced to merge with larger competitors to survive. Rolf managed to hang on by his fingernails.
Jacobi licked the tip of his finger and turned a page.
Then Hitler comes to power in Germany and starts making trouble for the Jews. Jewish money and valuables flow into the private banks of Zurich, including Rolf's.
You know this to be fact?
Absolutely. Augustus Rolf opened more than 200 numbered accounts for German Jews.
Jacobi turned over a few pages of the file.
Here's where the facts end and the rumors begin. In the late 30s, agents of the Gestapo start coming to Zurich. They're looking for all the Jewish money that's been spirited out of Germany and deposited in Swiss banks. It's rumored that Rolf cooperated with the Gestapo agents in violation of Swiss banking laws and revealed the existence of Jewish-held numbered accounts at his bank.
Why would he do that?
Would you like my theory?
Sure.
Because he knew that the money deposited by a few Jews was nothing compared to the riches that awaited him if he cooperated with Nazi Germany.
Is there evidence to suggest that he did?
Indeed,
Jacobi said, his eyebrows shooting up over the rims of his spectacles.
It's a fact that Augustus Rolf made frequent trips to Nazi Germany throughout the war.
Who did he see there?
It's not known, but his travels raised enough eyebrows that Rolf came under investigation after the war.
What came of it?
Absolutely nothing. Rolf melted back into the world of Zurich banking, never to be heard from again. Until a week ago, of course, when someone walked into his villa on the Zurich Berg and put a bullet in his head.
Jacobi closed the file and looked at Gabriel.
Would you care to pick up the story, Mr. Allon?
When Gabriel was finished, Professor Jacobi spent a long time polishing his spectacles on the fat end of his tie. Then he shoved them back onto his forehead and poured himself another cup of coffee.
It sounds as though you've run up against the great conspiracy of silence.
What do you mean by that?
When you're dealing with Switzerland, Mr. Allon, it's best to keep one thing in mind. Switzerland is not a real country. It's a business. And it's run like a business. It's a business that is constantly in a defensive posture. It's been that way for 700 years.
What does that have to do with Rolf's murder?
There are people in Switzerland who stand to lose a great deal if the sins of the past are exposed and the sewers of the Bahnhofstrasse are given the thorough flushing they so desperately need. These people are an invisible government and are not to be taken lightly, which is why I live here instead of Lausanne. If you choose to pursue this matter, I suggest you watch your back.
10 minutes later, Gabriel was walking down the stairs with his copy of The Myth tucked beneath his arm. He paused in the foyer for a moment to open the cover and read the words the professor had scrawled on the title page.
Beware the Gnomes of Zurich. Emil Jacobi.
That image of Gabriel was captured by the man with a long-range digital camera, standing in the window of the apartment house on the opposite side of the street. 1 hour earlier, he had also snapped a photograph of Gabriel's arrival. The pictures were not necessarily just a professional touch. Allon's entire conversation with Emil Jacobi had been picked up by the pair of sensitive transmitters the man had planted in the professor's apartment 6 months earlier. As Allon walked away, the surveillance artist fired off several more photographs. Then he sat down in front of his playback deck and listened to the tapes. After 30 minutes of steady work, he had completed a thorough transcript of the encounter. He spent 10 more minutes checking the transcription for accuracy. Then he encrypted the report and sent it via secure email to Zurich, along with the photographs of Allon. 30 seconds after that, the information appeared on the computer screen of Gerhard Peterson, who immediately picked up his telephone to request an urgent meeting with Herr Gessler. Gerhard Peterson did not like Emil Jacobi, and neither did Herr Gessler. Jacobi's one-man crusade against the financial oligarchy of Switzerland had become tiresome and costly. Both men agreed that it was time to deal with the meddlesome little professor. The following morning, before leaving his flat for the office, Gerhard Peterson made a telephone call from the privacy of his study. It lasted no more than 2 minutes. The fate of Emil Jacobi, the guilty conscience of Switzerland, had been sealed by a financial transaction, the transfer of $200,000 into a numbered account in Geneva controlled by Anton Orsatti. Gerhard Peterson found that very fitting indeed. Chapter 22. Costa da Prata, Portugal. When Gabriel arrived at Anna Rolf's villa the following morning, he was pleased to see it being guarded by at least 4 men, one at the gate, a second at the base of the vineyards, a third on the tree line, and a fourth perched on the hilltop. Shamron had sent Rami, his taciturn personal bodyguard, to supervise the detail. He greeted Gabriel in the drive. When Gabriel asked how Anna was dealing with the team, Rami rolled his eyes. You'll see soon enough. He entered the villa and followed the sound of Anna's violin up the staircase. Then he knocked on the door of her practice room and entered without waiting for permission. She spun round and berated him for interrupting her, then screamed at him for turning her home into an armed camp. As her tirade intensified, Gabriel looked down and fingered his bandages. A trickle of fresh blood had seeped through. Anna noticed this, too. Immediately she fell silent and gently led him to her bedroom to change his dressings. He couldn't help but look at her while she attended to him. The skin at the base of her neck was damp. The violin strings had left tiny valleys in the fingertips of her left hand. She was more beautiful than he remembered.
"Nice job," he said, inspecting her work. "I know something about bandaging hands, Mr. Allon. You have some things to tell me about my father, yes?"
"More questions than answers at this point. And please, call me Gabriel." She smiled.
"I have an idea, Gabriel."
In a nylon rucksack, Anna packed a picnic lunch of bread and cheese and cold chicken. Last, she added a chilled bottle of wine, which she wrapped in a woolen blanket before placing it in the bag. Rami gave Gabriel a beretta and a pair of boyish-looking bodyguards. On the shaded footpaths of the pine grove, with Rami's chaperones in close attendance, Gabriel told Anna about Paris. He did not tell her about his conversations with Julian Isherwood and Emile Jacobi. That could wait. The trees broke and the ruins appeared, perched on the face of a steep hillside. A wild goat hopped onto a granite boulder, bleated at them, then melted into the gorse. Gabriel shouldered the rucksack and followed Anna up the path. He watched the muscles of her legs flexing with each stride, and thought of Leia. A hike on an autumn day like this, 25 years earlier, only then the hillside had been in the Golan, and the ruins were crusader. Leia had painted. Gabriel had just returned from Europe, and his desire to create had been chased away by the ghosts of the men he had killed. He had left Leia at her easel, and climbed to the top of the hill. Above him had stood the military fortifications along the Syrian border. Below stretched the Upper Galilee and the rolling hills of southern Lebanon. Lost in thought, he had not heard Leia's approach.
"They're still going to come, Gabriel. You can sit there for the rest of your life looking at them. But they're still going to come."
And without looking at her, Gabriel had said,
"If I used to live there, in the Upper Galilee, and now I lived up there, in a camp in Lebanon, I'd come too."
The snap of Anna unfurling the picnic blanket shattered Gabriel's memory. She spread the blanket over a patch of sunlit grass, as Leia had done that day, while Gabriel ritually uncorked the wine. Rami's watchers took up their positions, one atop the ruins, one on the footpath below. As Anna pulled meat from the bones of the chicken, Gabriel showed her the photo of the man who had left the attaché bomb at the gallery.
"Ever seen him before?"
She shook her head. Gabriel put away the photo.
"I need to know more about your father."
"Like what?"
"Anything that can help me find out who killed him and took his collection."
"My father was a Swiss banker, Gabriel. I know him as a man, but I know next to nothing about his work."
This book is continued on Disc 5.